I've eaten too much meat.
I cut that out. Hello, and welcome to The Film File, episode 4, in which this week Andy talks film news. We're joined by a guest, and I'm Lee Ford.
I'm Andy Meakin.
And we're joined by...
Scott.
He's welcome back, Scott.
Back.
It's like a sequel that you never wanted. So let's just catch up with a little bit of housekeeping. As you know, last time we did The Film File, Andy and I were both a bit crook. We both got a cold. Andy, feeling better?
A lot better. I'm at that phase now where I just have random sneezing fits, but then I'm fine for most of the day.
I'm through with it. We had actually had a couple of messages from people who said, get better soon or die, whether you like the show or not. I'll leave that up to you.
I have to just mention with regards to the last recording, normally when it comes to the editing of this, you pretty much hear what we spoke. I only take about, maybe 30 seconds of total dead space. But on the last one, there was 9 minutes chopped because our heads were just not in the game.
Oh, it was hard work. It was hard work. But feeling much better this week. Anyway, that's housekeeping. Also, I just want to think on. Thank you for all of you, all of those who've subscribed to the show. Thank you so much. It makes us feel good about ourselves in ways that we can't explain. But pass on everything you know to your friends. Tell everybody about The Film File. We just got to get those numbers up because eventually we want to get people. We do this for free. We do this for the love of it. We do this for the love of film and cinema and all things media. But eventually we want to get people who want to chuck money at us so we can have fancy dinners other than the cakes that Andy's just laid out in front of me. But keep going. Keep with the reviews. Say nice things about us. It makes our self-esteem rise through the room.
Right.
Here we go with the worldwide news brought to you by Worldwide Andy.
I feel like I need a xylophone to go...
We've got to have something that goes off there.
So let's start with remake news because there's always another week, isn't it? It's another day, another remake. This one's one which has been buzzing around for a while, but it's starting to heat up now. The remake of Clue. Anyone a fan of the original Clue?
Tim Curry, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Martin Mull.
Yep.
Directed by Jonathan Lynn, who was responsible for Yes Minster. No, I've never seen it.
No. Actually, I mean, you know, the original is held in high regard by many. You much of a fan, Scott?
I've watched it. I get why it's become a cult film, hasn't it? Like a good, bad film. It's enjoyable, but I don't know if I'm...
Do you remember the thing about it? The American release, why it was different than the British release?
Three different endings. And cinemas didn't know which ending they would get.
Okay.
So audiences were going in not knowing how it was going to finish. And sometimes you could go to a different cinema and get a different ending. On the DVD and the home release, you can now see all three endings.
Oh, really?
It's been edited together to make it like, this could have happened, or this could have happened. But on the original release, it was such a great gimmick at the time.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting if they repeat that for the
remake. Yeah, I mean, because that could work really well on home release. Could be a gimmick for home release. But yes, that's how they did it in the cinema. They had different endings. So I don't know if anything, there was a plot point that changed halfway through or anything like that, but they had different endings for it.
But the remake is being greenlit as part of Ryan, my man crush, Reynolds's...
Who hasn't got a man crush on Ryan
3-year first look deal that he struck with Fox, which means that any new projects that get put into their stable, he gets a first pass on them. And he's decided to take his own production company to help develop it. He's brought on board the writing team that he's worked with on Deadpool and Life, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick.
Yeah, and they're coming back for Zombieland 2, aren't they, as well?
Yeah.
And they're working on fleshing out the script. And the most recent news is that Jason Bateman is in talks, not only to star alongside Reynolds, which that's a great combination, but also he's potentially going to direct the film as well.
He's directed some Arrested Development episodes. I like him. I think he's great, Jason Bateman. I watched Juno, funny enough, yesterday for the first time since it came out. I've not seen it again. He's so good in that role because his character turns on a dime. And what's so good about Juno, and we'll get back to talking about everything else, is the fact that he's the guy you trust and then sort of blows it halfway through. Spoilers if it's only been out since 2007. But... he plays it so well. And The Gift. Do you ever see The Gift?
No, I hear he's got quite a good turn in that, though.
Fantastic in The Gift. It was on Netflix. I don't know if it's moved on, but he's brilliant. And he's got that ease as a comedy actor, but he's also a good dramatic actor as well. So I'm interested. I'm very intrigued by this.
For us British people, Clue is actually Cluedo.
For those who didn't know.
So for those who've never seen the original film, it's basically a film adaptation of the board game where they're trying to find out who the killer is, with Professor Plum, did it Colonel in Mustard, etc.
Miss Scarlet, she did it in the library with a pole, apparently.
Yeah.
Well.
So, you know,
was it that kind of game?
Rumours be rumours.
Even though it's theoretically a remake of the film, it can go any way with the storyline because it is just a murder mystery comedy set in a big mansion.
Which, talking of which, Rian Johnson's new film,
Knives Out,
has that same sort of quality, that throwback to the old spooky house where there's a murder and a detective comes in to solve it. Looking forward to that. Great cast by the looks of that.
Absolutely brilliant cast.
Chris Evans.
Caught the trailer for the first time yesterday.
Yeah.
And that's
Craig.
I'm bought into it, even though Daniel Craig's accent is a bit weird in it because he's doing like a Texan drawl.
Apparently, that's the best accent for a Brit to do is a Southern American accent.
Oh, why?
It seems to be the easiest one to because it sort of draws in, apparently.
Or do you think it's more like most American media is based in the sort of North, New York or California, and they just go, oh, that's big.
That sounds like a Southern accent.
Do you know, like Southern English people go, that's Northern. Don't know where. That's it, North.
Moving on to Sony and the Spider-Verse series of films that are building and building and building.
Is this a sequel to Into the Spider-Verse?
No, nope, this is just all of the different Spider-related projects that they're all working on. Left, right and centre. I mean, we've already had talk of Silk, Night Watch, Black Cat, Kraven, Silver Sable. We've got Morbius in production at the moment. Now we've got Madam Web in development.
Which is a character you may not know if you're not a Spider-Man fan from
Scott,
the 1980s.
Tell us about Madam Web.
Madam Web's the weirdest Spider-Man character I can think of offhand. It's almost like a serious way of doing like a Batmite.
I never would have put it down as that.
She's like some sort of I don't know how cosmic she's linked, but she's somehow linked to Spider-Man and vested interest.
Over the years, they've taken the basic blind like character of Madame Web, who is a psychic, and they've extrapolated her storyline that she's not just a psychic, she's actually linked to the web that fuses the whole of the Spider-Verse together.
Right.
She could detect every multiverse version of any spider entity and follow the patterns and decipher where they're all going. And when those webs get, in the recent years on the comics, they've had like the webs started to get severed while people were destroying spiders around, and she detected it first. I'm imagining that they're going to go the more modern approach with Madam Web because there's a new Madam Web now. Because the old Madam Web used to just sit there and basically do nothing except for throw out cryptic clues every now and then.
She was an old lady in a chair, if I remember.
But the new one is like trench coat, like blindfold on, and very active and combat web ready because the original Madam Web has long since.
Sony would save an awful lot of money if it was just an old lady in a chair.
Yeah, a Mystic Meg.
Yeah.
With spiders.
This is where, like, I'm now referring to all their films, because whereas it was just, like, Spider-Man spin-offs, I'm referring to it as a Spider-Verse now, because if they're including Madam Web, they're including that for a reason, and I think they want to draw all of their spider franchises into the one story.
I'll bring you back to this, sir. Has she ever supported her own comic, never mind film?
No, she's always been a support character in the Spider titles.
So I know we've always talked about it because I think people who are into the Marvel films have always waited for it. They did it with Pixar, the film that will fail with the Marvel Studios. Then everybody thought it was going to be Ant-Man. And then, before that, everybody thought it was going to be Guardians. And at the moment, it's still a runaway truck. Sony are going to have that situation where one of them fails. We thought it was going to be Venom, but they did pretty good out of everything. Yeah. Mobius. There's been very little said about it. It's been in production for the last year, so I thought we might have seen some sort of teaser, if not a trailer for it by now. So they're going to push it too far. They're going to push the web. I know I said it, somebody had to, and it's going to break. Now they've got Spider-Man back. I'm sure they're going to be cautious about damaging their core brand, which is Spider-Man himself, and especially now they've still got Tom Holland, and they know they've got a winning formula. But, you know, there's still that chance. Still that chance that Marvel and Sony kiss and make up. It's a slim chance now, but from what
slimmer
I've heard,
slimmer.
There are still some amounts of negotiations. I don't know how true that is.
And breaking news, just as we're recording this podcast today, is that the deal between Disney and Sony has finally been worked out. Apparently, Disney are going to be taking a 25% takings, so they've backed down from their 50%. I did kind of speculate that it was going to be around about 30%-ish they'd probably settle on, so 25 sounds about the ballpark. And that means that for the next Spider-Man film, Feige will be helping coordinate it. And it also gives an option for Spider-Man to be used in the MCU for one other film. There we have it. It's all been dealt with and all been sorted. At the same time, we've still got the sequel to Venom, which is going to be directed by Andy Serkis. But he's now brought on board one of the producers from the X-Men franchise, Hutch Parker. Read into that what you want to, because at the end of the day, the X-Men franchise isn't anything to hold in huge regard these days.
I had a discussion recently with the content being the X-Men series. If you've only joined it late, you forgot how impactful X-Men was when it came out. And when X2 hit the screen, it was almost a perfect version of the X-Men. I know it starts to feel dated in the sense of what's come after it, and Marvel changed the game with that. But there's a lot to remember that how powerful X2 was when it came out. And it's up there with the Spider-Man 2, with Superman the movie, has been one of those game changers.
Absolutely. And as I was saying on Marvel bonus one as well, even quite late in the game when we were a bit disillusioned with Fox because of all the continuity errors and the miscasts and all of that, they were still doing Logan, Deadpool.
Mm.
Still interesting turns and shouts. So they've been relevant to the very end, even if it doesn't feel that way after Dark Phoenix.
Yeah, I think they just lost the way with it.
Dark Phoenix, the film in which there was a funeral scene set in the rain, of which the whole impact is lost because Storm is stood there and she could have stopped it raining on them. But no, she thought,
did she
no,
cause
you know
it?
What? Yeah. I'm going to let everyone get soaked because everything's that miserable now.
Her powers might be emotive, so she wants to cry.
It rains. Oh, I see what you did there. It's like a carpenter's
Storm,
video.
You're not invited to any more funerals. Go away.
Yeah, bring a brolly. We'll have them inside.
Grieve on your own.
But one of the reasons that was cited for the recent breakup of the Sony-Disney deal was Kevin Feige and having a...
Shall we just stop there? The great Kevin Feige, I think you should always start with that.
And he had a huge workload and he couldn't dedicate the time to overseeing the production of the Spider-Man films anymore, which it was like, okay, so how has he managed this far? Because has he got anything new?
He does three films
as it is. We've recently discovered in the past few days that, yes, he has got something new.
Yeah, he's apparently producing a Star Wars film, isn't he? It's tough.
Can I just say, stop you there, Scott, because it was how nonchalantly you put, apparently he's going to be producing a Star Wars film.
Because, legit, if you write every producer in the history of cinema's credentials on a piece of paper, Kevin Feige's like a superstar, hit after hit after. However, he's done it playing with his own toys in a toolbox with all the keys to the kingdom. Being like more of an ambassador for the Star Wars property and producing a single Star Wars film, he's not proven he can do that necessarily.
No, absolutely.
So whilst, yes, good, deserves a chance, I'm not as excited as I imagine most people are, because I'm a bit trepidantly, okay, you've not done this before. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I'm muted because I don't want Kevin Feige to leave Marvel.
Yeah.
He steered a ship in a way that 10 years ago when we first saw Iron Man, we were cautious and happy just to see those characters on screen and portrayed with love and affection for them and an understanding of characters. And if you've grown up with comic book movies, you know, nothing was ever worse than the introduction of a villain that they created just for the film. I'm looking at you, Superman 4. Superman 3, don't you leave the room yet. But there came to it a legitimacy and a sense of itself, and Kevin Feige was responsible for that. He clearly knows how to get talent on board that tells a bigger story, and he's part of a known universe. And then, yes, there were universes before Marvel, but no one recognised them in the way that they are now. And he's responsible for that. He's made some very bold moves. He's an interesting producer. I'd like to see him play in a different sandbox.
Yeah.
But I don't want him to do that at the expense of the Marvel films, because he clearly loves the franchises, whether you like them or not. I've got friends who don't care for them, are big comic fans. But you've got to admit what he's done. When I was 10, 12 years old and reading comics, it was always the furthest thing from your head that you could see a film. You would sit through Nicholas Hammond playing Spider-Man just to get a glimpse of the costume and somebody playing that role live. So I'm interested, until we know more details about it. But people like Chris Evans have said, if it's Kevin Feige's doing it, I will do it.
Yep. he'll be able to secure some good names, like you said. He's going to be obviously working alongside Kathleen Kennedy, who's...
Yeah, she steers the ship now. She's the Kevin Feige of the Star Wars universe, isn't she?
And it's Alan Horn, the chief creative officer, has issued a statement confirming the details. And within it, he said, with the close of the Skywalker saga, Kathy's pursuing a new era in Star Wars storytelling. And knowing what a diehard fan Kevin is, it made sense for these two extraordinary producers to work on a Star Wars film together. See, if he is genuinely a diehard fan, I'm hoping he uses it to see the potential for that whole universe. Because as I've said many times, the problems that I've had so far with the non-numbered Star Wars spin-off films is they've been too close to the numbered ones story-wise. They've felt like they've had to interlink into them. Did we need a Solo backstory? No, we didn't need to know how he got the name Solo. I was quite happy to just know he's called Solo.
Liked it, but I totally agree.
And Rogue One, I just felt, was just there. And you could see that it being like chopped and edited around and changed. And there was bits from the trailers that didn't make into the end film. And it didn't seem quite seem like the film that it wanted to be to start with, because they tried to make it more like the Star Wars films. I'm hoping that now they can just go, right, we've got a huge galaxy. Now we can tell completely separate stories. The Skywalker lot is all out the way. We don't need to do anything linking to there. Save them for the TV shows, you know, where you've got like the Obi-Wan series that they're working on. Do the TV shows linking into the Skywalker story, but let the films grow in their own way. Rian Johnson still developing his new trilogy, which is going to be a whole new story in a whole new era. That's what I get excited about. Yeah. We were only talking just before we started recording that we're not feeling the buzz for episode 9.
That's interesting. Is it too early?
It's 2 months away.
My
only theory on that is Last Jedi went so out of its way to subvert expectation. And it's got interesting character moments and interesting subversions. However, it doesn't leave you with an Empire Strikes Back, like, I need to watch the last installment ending, as much as
did we all come at Last Jedi with a sense of expectation of what we thought the kind of film it was going to be? Did we instantly all assume this is the second part of a trilogy, therefore it needs to be Empire?
Not necessarily.
And did he subvert that? Is that a discussion for another time?
I think that's a discussion for a whole bonus episode.
Bonus episode coming soon.
Yeah, we'll have a bonus episode.
The subversion of the Empire.
The MTOS questions around the Star Wars franchise. I'll have to think of those ones. But yeah, I mean, we'll get back to that on like another time when we can discuss it in more depth. But I do think it's because Last Jedi was very polarizing in the opinions. And I was very much on the side of, it feels like he's just undone everything that JJ was setting up. And whilst JJ's back to tidy things up and finish it all off, it just feels that in the end that it's possibly going to end up that The Last Jedi is just a off piece from what should have been one continuous story.
Yeah.
And that's where I have the problems with it. And I think that's why I'm not feeling the buzz for it, because I'm worried that JJ is just going to use it to undo what was done in Last Jedi, the same way that Last Jedi undid what was done in False Awakens. And I don't feel that that makes for a good story.
It's a mosaic instead of a picture.
Yeah. Right, moving away from space to A Quiet Place. And we all saw A Quiet Place, yeah?
We did. A fantastic film. And I'll quickly, before you move on, because I always do this, I know. It scared me to death going into the cinema to see that film, because so much is invested in a good audience. If you got a rowdy audience or an audience who weren't with it at any point, it would have spoilt the sense of that film. But thankfully, I saw it with an audience. And I was worried because it felt like an unsettled audience for the first minute or so, and then they got into it. And you need silence. You need an audience to be silenced. It puts the pressure on the audience to be respectful of each other and the film. But going on to Quiet Place 2.
So John Krasinski's confirmed that shooting has wrapped on the sequel in that manner that everyone confirms that shooting's wrapped these days, by posting a photo on Twitter and Instagram. This one of him and his wife, Emily Blunt, stood on the bridge hand in hand. Emily Blunt is obviously returning for the sequel, and she's joined by Noah Jupe, Millicent Simmons, Cillian Murphy, and Jaimon Hounsou.
Interesting guys. I like Cillian Murphy.
Yep. I like Jaimon Hounsou. I think he's someone who just should be in a lot more films. You see him from time to time and you go, wow. He should be an A-lister, but he's still just that supporter in everything. But he's a great supporter. He always brings something to every role.
He's a character actor.
The film is going to explore the larger world, because the last film was very self-contained in like just that farm. And it was just, we just saw how it was impacted on that one family. Now it's got to branch out and let us see, how's the rest of the world coping with these creatures attacking. Are the creatures attacking everywhere in the world, or is it isolated to certain areas? So it's got so much potential to really grow this idea. I love the idea of the film. I love, like you say, the audience has embraced it, and we're quiet. Working in a cinema, we were expecting to get like people coming out saying, someone's making noise, someone's doing this, someone's doing that. No, so you pop your head into the screen and everyone's just sat in silence.
It's that thing of having to read, wasn't it? And it was a thing of the shared experience of the silence and what was going to come out of the silence. Very good film. It worked on all the best elements of being a horror film. And it was a horror film. It was a monster movie at its very, very heart. It offered something more. It offered a cerebral quality to a good horror film. And it didn't do the thing that sometimes that genre does. It didn't forget its roots, that this is, in fact, first a monster movie.
Yeah.
And then go, I'm going to build on the other monster movie. It always frustrates me when you get a horror film or a supernatural film and the director says, yeah, it's an art film. The monsters are, you know, it's about the deeper dark psyche. No, it's a monster film first, and it understood that and it appreciated that. And that's why it worked. And it allowed to add family tension and get away with the conceit of it being in silence. Fantastic film. I hope it doesn't let down the legacy of the first film. And it could be, from what you've just described, Andy, it could be the aliens to the first film, yeah. Alien.
The first film is very claustrophobic, yeah, contained. Very tense. Then it can go wider and see the battle against the creatures.
And with that cast as well, with Krasinski being back in the director's chair, yeah, and the same writers, then I've got a lot of faith.
He's got a great
eye
for a good shot.
Yeah.
I'm going to quickly skip across to our DC expert at the table. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Batman casting. What's the latest word on the Batmans?
Jeffrey Wright's been cast to play Commissioner Gordon.
Great actor.
Which, obviously, because he has a different ethnicity, causes debate. That I'm not even convinced there is a debate. I think people.
I don't think there is. I
agree
with you on that.
People preempt it by going, there's probably a debate out there, so this is my two penny. I've not personally heard a single person say anything other than, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I like him as an actor. He did it once before. He played Felix Leiter in the Bond series, Daniel Craig Bond series. No one mentioned then that we'd race jump to it with that character. Commissioner Gordon, it doesn't matter, does it?
No.
It doesn't matter if he's a white guy, a black guy, an Asian guy. It's Commissioner Gordon is essential for his role in the stories.
Yeah, if you've got a bit of gravitas in a trench coat, I feel like you're pretty much there.
Yeah.
It's like when Perry White was Lawrence Fishburne.
Did it matter?
No, it doesn't, does it? You're quibbling.
And we had this discussion a few episode two. If the character doesn't demand it, then it's about finding the good actor for it. And I think Jeffrey Wright is a fantastic actor. I loved his work in Westworld.
And then Jonah Hill as well, and there's a lot of debate whether he's going to be the Penguin or the Riddler.
Which would be the obvious choice, the Penguin.
Well, it depends on his weight situation, doesn't it?
He's kind of shed a lot. So.
Because he blooms and shrinks so rapidly, he's good for both, depending on where he's at.
And the rumour I've heard is it's the last Halloween storyline.
Which is great. I've wanted a proper detective Batman since day one. We've had every other variant. We've had hints of slight bit of detective work here and there, but one that's just a crime story, just straight up mystery.
We've not had the detective Batman, I feel, since the first Tim Burton Michael Keaton, which we saw him being a detective and sorting out the plot of the Joker.
He did it
as a detective as opposed to banging heads.
Yeah, we usually get scenes to go, oh, Andy's a detective, rather than he is a detective first and foremost, and then whatever.
Remember, the name's in the comics, kids. Detective Comics.
Is that where it came from? Oh, I was always wondering. So out of the two characters that he's been tipped for, that people are speculating, which one would you?
Riddler.
I think Riddler. Well, I'm dying for a decent live-action Riddler. That's not Jim Carrey by way of Frank Ocean. Just a more sinister, egomaniacal.
You mean like Frank Ocean?
Frank Ocean's great for the 60s Batman. Fantastic.
He felt dangerous, Frank Ocean's.
But I just feel like we're at a point, I want a different filter for that. Like,
I always said, like, you know, when Nolan was doing the Batman films, if he had brought Riddler in, I thought he would have done an interesting kind of take in that context. Because when you think about it, Riddler is someone who is so mentally unstable that he kind of wants to get caught in the act.
That's what I mean.
And lays down these these clues to try to get caught. And he's got a thrill out of trying to get caught. And there's such a dark psyche that can be explored
you
there.
You could do like a Zodiac Killer-esque
Son
of Sam taunting thing where he's like, come get me.
It's funny, I've just read Year Zero, the Scott Snyder version take on it. And that was that Riddler.
He's always been seen as a C-list. He's obviously a joke if you want him to be. But like you said, if you want to deep delve into the psyche, that would, if you filter that through a real context, it's really disturbing and you can do something really cool and interesting with that character. Whereas Penguin, it's always going to be a mob boss. We've kind of seen it.
Yeah. I think Penguin was explored quite well on the Gotham TV series.
Yeah, it's the best thing that did.
I'd like them to maybe not explore that route again because that kind of held Gotham together.
Yeah.
The other characters that came in and out were good, but it was Penguin that was, for me, the focus for that series.
Mm.
His rise to power. So moving on to Ridley Scott's new revenge drama that's not even in production yet and not even been greenlit yet, but has already got names attached.
I don't know anything about this one.
It's called The Last Duel and it's set in the 14th century of France. The story is following a soldier who returns from war to find that his best friend had abused his wife, the soldier's wife. And so he seeks an audience with the king in order to get permission to have a duel, because at that point, duels, you have to go through the king to get them authorised, and it becomes the last duel in recorded history.
Interesting. And also going back on himself, was his second film, was it his first film? Was
Duelists.
Was a duelist.
Yeah. At the moment, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are connected to star.
You were shocked then, aren't you?
I was just like, the two names that you so automatically put together, you almost purposely keep them apart in these projects. Do you know what I mean? Like,
and it's now added the recent Best Actress Emmy winner, Jodie Comer from Killing Eve, into the mix. Now, this is something that isn't greenlit yet, but already has those three names attached. So everyone is expecting that the green light will go within the next few days and it'll start shooting early next year. I'm excited for it. Like you say, it's returning back to an old kind of theme that he's done. Mm. And I think Ridley Scott has so much potential to like revisit his old ideas and really deliver something spectacular. And with those names on board, I'm already in.
His light's been a little bit dimmed recently, hasn't it? And with Alien Covenant not really delivering much of anything, to be honest. It was the most un-Ridley Scott film I think I've ever seen. It didn't have what one would expect. It was just a replay. In fact, the video game, Alien Isolation, was a better film.
Yeah.
It was much better than Covenant ever was. And then I didn't see the one that came out last year about the kidnapping all the money of the world. Is it?
I'm not too sure.
And it was the one where Kevin Spacey was originally. And Son of Postcard, Please, Folks.
I know which one you mean.
And that sort of disappeared. And that was a big Christmas Day release. So he's reached the stage where I think he's got to come back with something that proves that he's still got that Ridley Scott magic, to almost like the line out of Blade Runner. But Ridley Scott's one of these directors that his work's been copied by so many people. His style has been picked up and run with the ball that he has to find something unique. He can't consistently make a Ridley Scott-looking film because he's done that so many times. But I'd like to see him come back with some great material and just show again that he can do great visuals, because he's a fantastic visualist, with better stories that engage and shows him to his true potential.
When was the last time you were excited about one of his films?
That's a good... Well, Prometheus was the one that I think I was excited for, because I think expectation on Prometheus was bigger and better than the film.
Mm.
And I have revisited Prometheus, and I like it a lot more a second and third time around, but it's not classic Ridley Scott.
I can't think of anything north of Gladiator.
Yeah, there was the... There's very little in the way of what you consider that bold.
20 years of
Ridley Scott film.
It's been a couple of decades where there's not been anything that's stood out. So maybe this will be the return to form that we've all been waiting for.
Let's hope so, because he's always a director worth seeing.
The franchise that depends on nostalgia to keep going despite an ever-spiralling decay of quality is going full nostalgia for the next outing, as Laura Dern, Sam Neill and Jeff Goldblum have all been given extended roles in Jurassic World 3.
This came out of nowhere this week. This landed, this news landed this week with some amount of raised eyebrows, certainly from my quarter. The first question was why?
Chucking everything out wall.
And why I think the Jurassic franchise has sort of ebbed itself into a corner.
Yeah.
and wedged itself in quite nicely that it can only go one direction and nothing much in the way of surprises. It was the last film, the last Kingdom film, was very disappointing, even though it looked fantastic and there were some great moments in it. But ultimately, what a mishmash of a storyline where the what should have been an apt conclusion happened halfway through the film. I think they missed opportunities right, left and centre. Lost World 3.
Yeah, Pratt and Howard are back on the cast list and Colin Trevorrow is returning to direct and part write the story.
I think they got away with the first one because the first one almost powered off nostalgia.
Oh, it was pure nostalgia fuel.
And the one thing they've not done, imagine if this part worked for a bit.
Yeah.
And then play back to what's happened before. And then after that, I feel it's played. It's all played. Tell me an angle of these dinosaurs.
I'm just expecting nice, friendly velociraptors again. Another T-Rex scene that just comes out of nowhere and doesn't really do anything. And maybe another bloody hybrid.
Yeah.
Because that's what they fell back on in the past two films. And it's like, really? We don't need another hybrid? I'm not expecting much of a plot, character development, or a reason to care, to be honest with you.
It's almost like we talked about Star Wars earlier in the programme, which it feels a little bit tainted, much more so than coming back into the Star Wars universe. Other than making money, which of course is very valid in Hollywood, and please don't get me wrong, that's how films do well. I think it's run its course.
Yeah.
I think it came back. I think it came back fairly strong, and I understood why they rehashed it, because it brought in a new audience who'd not seen Jurassic Park. It brought in kids who Jurassic Park felt old-fashioned to. But nothing's going to take away from what Jurassic Park did when you first saw it and you were in awe and wonderment of it. It was one of those movies that changed cinema, even though you probably didn't realise it was changing cinema.
Yeah.
But we'll see. It's good to see Goldblum on screen in anything he does. I'm not overly optimistic. I will probably see it. I'll probably see it with one of you guys.
G.I. Joe. Do you remember those films?
They lasted all of two films, didn't they?
Well, they're getting a reboot stroke spin-off.
It only can be one character.
Snake Eyes.
Snake Eyes.
The only character that anyone in those past two films went, oh, that'd be an interesting character to explore, and it's took them this long to go, yeah, but we're going to recast and get a completely different thing and start it as a new franchise.
And the character doesn't speak, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. It's going to be set in the early days of Snake Eyes, played by Henry Golding, who is being opposed by Andrew Coey from Warrior, who's Storm Shadow. The film is going to look at the early days of Snake Eyes as an induction into the Ninja Clan. If you thought that we didn't want, need, or deserve a reboot spin-off of the G.I. Joe film, maybe the director attached will change your mind. He gave us Red, Retired Extremely Dangerous.
Okay, yeah, I liked Red.
However, he also gave us R.I.P.D.
I liked Red.
But he's not acronyming this time. Maybe it's a good sign.
Oh, this is where it ends up. S.N.A.K.E. Eyes.
It takes you 10 minutes to ask for the film.
October 2020 is the month that you need to be looking to see what else is coming out, because that's when it's expected to land.
Snake Eyes.
Oh, 2020. No.
I get this big feeling there are, and we know this to be true. It's not even speculation. There are guys in executives' office who are kind of our age, who grew up on cartoons and grew up on a pop culture, and are bringing that pop culture to the big screen. However, there's a younger generation. You've got kids who don't know this thing, this world, and we rely on them. It's when they suggest, you know, would it be great to do a Major Matt Mason film, which they've announced with Tom Hanks. I remember Major Matt Mason. I'm probably one of the only kids in my school who had one and the little book that went with it. It wasn't a name that was internationally known, but there's an executive who played with the Major Matt Mason when he was a kid and has had a lifelong dream to see him on the big screen. It's when we start scraping the bottom of the franchise barrel that then it becomes desperate.
Yeah.
And then that's when those franchises aren't found by an audience, because those audiences are now 30 to 40 year old guys upwards, rather than 13 to 15, 16 year olds who are the ones that we should be won over. How many times do they want us to bring Battlestar Galactica back? And there's talk of a reboot right now. It's running out of steam. We are a lot older. You can't aim it at 13 and 14 year olds anymore.
Every 3 or 4 years, I hear the rumor of a Captain Planet movie.
Yeah.
And every time I think, oh, I'll watch it. But why?
Yeah.
And It's just.
But your kids wouldn't get that reference.
No, they'd have no interest in it. No.
Yeah. It wasn't even good at the time.
No.
It's like we just remember it because we were of an age.
I mean, if even a more recent kind of phenomenon for kids can come to the big screen and not really have much of an impact, and I'm talking Dora the Explorer here,
yeah. Which is supposed to be a very good film, from what I've heard,
it just didn't get the impact.
Yeah,
and that's two generations after us, basically.
Yeah.
So you know they are looking too far back to things that are completely obscure these days.
Yeah,
and it's the wrong road to go. By all means, TV shows of the 80s and everything, which get repeated constantly on TV. You know, I'd love to see another A-Team on the big screen. I quite enjoyed The Last Outing. It was a good bit of fun. But don't just go to toy lines that have been long out of production.
Yeah.
And try to revisit them as though it's some kind of like great mythology. It was never a great mythology. It was a cartoon series designed to sell toys.
Yes.
Are you looking forward to the Polly Pocket movie in 2021?
Then? Oh, top of my list, man. If that doesn't get all the Oscars, I don't know what will. To wrap up the news this week.
You know someone's going to get in touch with him and go, is there really?
To wrap up the news this week, after all the levity of us discussing all the other things, let's just take a moment of melancholy to mourn the passing of Sid Haig, known for his iconic Captain Spaulding role in Rob Zombie's films. If you're not a fan of Rob Zombie films, I'm not a huge fan.
No, me neither. But
he was iconic within them. Even like I've watched them and I go, well, I can see why the fuss was around him. The rest of the film fell apart around him. But, you know, he's been present throughout the decades from the exploitation films of the 70s, like Foxy Brown. He's been present in TV shows. You've pretty much seen him in something from Man from U.N.C.L.E., Batman, A-Team, MacGyver, Hill Street Blues, Charlie's Angels. He was even given some roles in Jackie Brown by Tarantino and Kill Bill Volume 2. So you might not recognise the name, but he's one of those faces that you would have recognised every time that he popped up on screen. His final appearance is in the third one of Rob Zombie's trilogy, The Three from Hell.
Right.
Which has had limited release and it's probably going to get a wide release. It probably is. But, you know, it's a sad loss of someone who has had such a prevalent role as a supporting actor in so many things throughout the decades. And, you know, it's I think, you know, whilst it didn't relate to his work with Rob Zombie, once I saw a picture of him without all that makeup on, it was like, oh, no, I do recognise
him. Yeah, you would do. And it's always good that, you know, the opposite of what we've just talked about with the nostalgia factor with toys. It's always great to see those actors that have been loved. I mean, Tarantino's done this countless of times, putting Nicholas Hammond in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's great that appreciation for those character actors and those people from your past whose careers may have dried up a little bit to give them a new lease of life. You know, he did it with John Travolta, believe it or not.
Yeah.
If you think about it, John Travolta was kind of washed up.
And he brought him back.
Well, he's there again now, so.
Yeah, well, you know, Tarantino stopped working with him.
So that's the news. If you've got any gossip, anything you want to tell us, drop us a line via Twitter on...
@FilmFileUK.
And we'd be looking forward to hearing from you. If you want to just say nice things about us, as I said before, please get in touch. It's your reviews that really, really help. So, since we spoke to you last episode, we talked about It Chapter 2. We're going to be talking about a film that's had a very mixed reaction from the critics. A lot of them saying it a masterpiece, and it's yet failing to find a great audience. No, we're not talking about Joker, because it's not being released yet. That's next week, isn't it?
It is next week.
We can't wait. Maybe we'll have to do a special Joker episode, I think. But we're talking about Ad Astra, directed by James Gray, starring Brad Pitt. I saw it. Andy saw it. Scott's not seen it yet.
No.
So we're gonna talk about that, and we're going to be talking about how science fiction is now being portrayed on the big screen. And as the era of the big, more cerebral science fiction films gone. But first, Ad Astra.
What can you tell us about the Lima Project?
The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir.
Your father was experimenting with a highly classified material that could threaten our entire solar system. All life could be destroyed. We're counting on you. Find out what's happening.
I love you. I worry about you.
Are you truly sure that you're ready to go on this voyage?
I'm ready. We're going to be entering hostile territory.
But the mission is the priority. We cannot stop.
I
Nothing can prepare you for what is out there.
So Ad Astra is basically Hearts of Darkness, or for those who don't know, Hearts of Darkness, Apocalypse Now, set in space.
It even has a Colonel Kurtz type sequence at the end.
Yep. Brad Pitt is the key character in it. He plays Major Roy McBride, a man who's always lived in the shadow of his father's legend, H. Clifford McBride, played by Tommy Lee Jones, who led a secret project 16 years ago to reach the outskirts of the solar system in search for intelligent life. A series of pulses from near Neptune caused worldwide power surges, and Roy's sent on a top-secret mission to Mars to try to establish communications with his father and discover what's happening. The journey, as with Hearts of Darkness, sees the pitfalls of man around him, while Roy's internal journey of the soul also plays out.
It is very much 2001 meets Apocalypse Now. And I had not read anything. I deliberately avoided it. I'd seen that it got great reviews. I'd seen a couple of poor reviews, but I stayed away from it. So I went in with a clean expectation of what I was about to expect. And I thoroughly loved it. I thought it looked fantastic. It had almost a retro 2001-esque view of it. It was very, very stylized. Stylized in the way that an art movie would, to a degree. I thought Brad Pitt was fantastic in it. The voiceover reminded me of Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. I really, really walked out and I loved it. And then suddenly something happened. I heard other reviews and saw other reviews. And it sort of knocked me back a little bit, because I'd gone in having a great time. Yes, it was beautiful. It was very well done. It was flawed. Flawed in some of the plot areas. But I did have a good time. And has that ever happened to you? You ever walked out of a film, you loved it, then you read a review and you go, was I right? Was I wrong on this?
To a degree. Well, I'm one of those people, I'm sure you two are exactly the same way. You're digesting it for days after the fact, yeah. Anyway. So I think some of that's almost a natural digestion period in a weird way, because obviously people can point stuff out. You probably know it consciously or unconsciously yourself, and you weigh that up on its own merits. But I don't think anyone's changed my opinion after the fact. But people have helped me articulate my initial feeling in that period of time. And then it usually sets, doesn't it, until you watch it again.
Yeah, it drew my attention to the flaws and some of the flaws that it was an amazing essay, an amazing visual journey. I thought Pitt was fantastic. I liked where it was going. It had these strange moments where it drifted into an action movie and then drifted back out of it. It's almost chapter headings on each part of the journey. Those were the little bits that threw me out. I was more interested in almost the internal journey, but it looked beautiful. So whenever it did veer off, whenever it did feel a little bit awkward, I was always drawn back to how that it was a brave science fiction film to make in this day and age. And that surprised me, I mean, to say that, because we've now at a place where we're not adverse to seeing amazing special effects anymore. Very rarely are we blown away. There were moments of this which were, the effects wise, were very practical looking. And had a sense of real drama again, and real scope and real scale. But it made me think that, is the big science fiction film dead? If this is not really finding its audience, because it is more of a thought journey than an action film, have we reached a stage where we can't have a 2001 anymore? I was thinking of Annihilation, which ended up going straight to Netflix because it didn't really find an audience, or wasn't perceived to find an audience on the big screen. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, there's over the past few years, there have been that style of like classic sci-fi brought to the big screen that have been successful. Interstellar,
yeah,
for example, was a box office smash. But, you know, was it the fact that Nolan's name was attached to it that drew the audiences in more than anything else? Who knows? Gravity, yeah. Gravity was more a disaster movie in space.
True.
So it really did have like the action. I think The Martian is probably going to be the one that stands out as being like it. That is the same kind of like one man journey,
yeah,
kind of thing of this. Not a lot happens in The Martian, but you're engrossed throughout, and audiences embrace that.
I think that was down to casting. I think Matt Damon in that role, and it was a warm role, and the Brad Pitt character in this is a much more isolated. He's a cold character from the get go, and that's his journey. Matt Damon was on full tilt. Matt Damon, yeah. Likeable character, and it was jokey. And Drew Goddard made quite an impenetrable book very, very into a very enjoyable film. And it makes me think now: is there a new genre called the sad astronaut? Have we discovered this? This is a every couple of years the lone single sad astronaut film.
Well, I always think sci-fi, good sci-fi, if not all sci-fi, it's using fantastical scientific elements to discuss the human condition, isn't it? And whatever our concerns are for whatever period it's made. So a lot of sci-fi is so prevalent, it's obviously around, but I find they're always in the like Moon or District 9 molds of a more sort of subtle commentary or threat on the human condition. Whereas the more exploratory space thing, they're usually happening periods of optimism, growth in humanity and reaching for the stars. We've not had that for years, have we?
No.
But even Interstellar, it's more of a ode to humanity and what we've done and what we could do than anything like, we will get here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I was thinking of Blade Runner, the Blade Runner sequel, which was beautiful, was a unique film, but didn't find an audience.
No.
And it was a big scale. You had to see it on, you had to see it in IMAX to really appreciate it. But we'd moved on. An audience has moved on. And I just wonder if the home of the cerebral sci-fi isn't there. You know, people's cinemas have become more like your lounge, and your lounge has become more like a cinema now. So does it matter? I not found myself wanting to watch the Blade Runner sequel at home. I know it's up on Netflix right now, because it will underscore what that film's about for me, because I needed that big screen. I found it so immersive.
Mm.
But does it work better because it's a much more personal journey? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I mentioned Star Trek The Motion Picture as being a perfect example of wanting to do a cerebral science fiction film, while Star Wars had just done remarkably well and sort of pipped it at the post to the big screen in a way that have we moved on from that? But I hope not, because there's always a place for good science fiction.
Using Star Trek The Motion Picture, I mean, that is sneered at. I mean, I love the film, and there are like it has got a lot more people becoming fans of it now.
I liked it. I liked it a lot.
More and more. But at the time, it was very much, it got referred to very frequently as the slow motion picture. Yeah. Nothing happens. It's drawn out. There's no need for this. So then the second film, Wrath of Khan, action, adventure. And people lapped that up, and that got the franchise completely moving. Mm. Sci-fi today, the ones that seem to get the box office blockbuster impact seem to be the ones that grab the action adventure type of things.
That's what I mean. We're looking for escapism right now in terms of, obviously, we're living more cynical times, whereas I can't think of a franchise more like defiantly hopeful than Star Trek. In its very bones and DNA, pretty much, it's conceived that way, isn't it? And even that, yes, it's on Netflix and CBS, Star Trek Discovery. But people criticise that as being a bit too dark, a bit too Star Wars bent, a bit too what? At war.
Whilst you've got like the Orville, which is inspired by the Next Generation era of Star Trek, that is a lot more optimistic and happy and friendly. And yeah, maybe that is.
I think it's a times thing.
A sign of the times thing is that we're living in an era where, well, let's be honest, the world leaders of the superpowers are not anything to be proud of.
Yeah, and the science fiction that always relates
to that. And
maybe
we don't want to go to the cinema to be a bit more depressed.
Yeah.
But that's not saying that, I mean, get back to Ad Astra, it's not a depressing film.
Far from it.
It's a very touching, very emotional film, and Brad Pitt is absolutely stellar throughout it. And that's not to disregard the supporting cast. I mean, even Ruth Negga, when she pops up in a very small role.
Donald Sutherland, one of my favourites.
She just steals the screen. Yeah, I mean, when he like is in it towards the start of the film, it's just like, whoa, hang on, I've not seen you for ages.
Yeah. And he was at his most Donald Sutherland as well.
Straight away, you just fall in love with that character.
Like
it's a great film with a great cast, but all held together by Brad Pitt's voiceover, his journey, his characters like growing out of his father's shadow, becoming himself and learning to be who he could be and who he should be. Absolutely marvellous film.
Loved and it's it. Still playing.
And like you say, there's flaws, but I think the sign of a good film is one that even when you can recognise the flaws, you can still love that film. Because there's no such thing as a perfect film. I don't care what anyone says. I get it all the time about Citizen Kane. Now, Citizen Kane's not a perfect film. There's a flaw right in the opening scene of that, and I'm not going to talk about it here because I've spoken about it so many times. But the very opening scene, who heard that word, Rosebud? No one. No one was in the room. But you overlook things like that because the film has grasped you on an emotional core. And it's made you think, and you have gone away and you've thought about it and you've researched other people's opinions because it's put you in a position where you've gone, well, actually, that's what the film's supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be getting us to think about it. And that's what good film does for me. And like you say, it's a shame that they're not having the impact on the big screen, as long as we can get them in some form. The small screen is nothing to be sneered at. I mean, Scorsese's Irishman is just around the corner.
New trailer out this week.
But yeah, visually, I think that the big screen needs to be seen for Ad Astra, because I don't think the visuals will convey as well and as impressive on whatever size TV you got at home.
And Astra's still in your cinemas right now. Try and see it on the biggest screen possible, or just see on a screen outside of your home, because it's well worth it. Which leads us on to your neat things, guys. What have we got?
Before we do the neat things, quickly mention a film out this weekend, Ready or Not.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And now I don't have a chance to see
it. It's not been hugely promoted.
Comedy horror?
Comedy horror. A beautiful, dark comedy. Samara Weaving plays Grace, the newly wedded wife of Alex Ladomar, who's played by Mark O'Brien, and finds herself on the run from the family she's joined thanks to a wedding day ritual of gaming that turns into a vicious game of hide and seek. It's bloody, brutal, deliciously darkly comical. The film's a joyful, tight 90 minutes long, with some squeams and some screams. It's fantastically thrown together with a brilliant cast of oddball characters that you will have recognised from various TV shows and other films, but you'll never be able to remember the names of, and that's how I'm getting away with not knowing their names right now. But it's an utter joy of a comedy horror. I thoroughly recommend it to everyone. Go and see it. 90 minutes of your life that you will just want to revisit and revisit and revisit. I can't wait to pick this up on home release and just keep rewatching it. Brilliant film.
Fantastic recommendation. And that's playing right now. So, as I was about to say, neat things. Who's got a one neat thing?
Well, I want to throw out, I'm going to comics this time. And I'm 6 months behind on the Marvel comics in general because I use Marvel Unlimited. And I want to mention Marvel Unlimited as the big neat thing, because Marvel Unlimited is a subscription service to Marvel comics that you can get on tablet devices, or you can use on a PC, or even on your phone if you want to go frame by frame. It's up to you. It costs about £50 a year. And you have an archive of Marvel comics leading back to the start of the eras, and they're constantly adding new comics in. Like I say, it has all the comics from 6 months ago go on there. So as soon as it's been on the shelf for 6 months, they go onto there, which means that I'm currently catching up on Spider-Man's Hunted storyline, which is a Kraven the Hunter one, which is brilliantly put together in such a way that it echoes so many aspects of Kraven's Last Hunt, which for me was the definitive Kraven story.
That was a J.M. DeMatteis, Mike Zeff.
Yeah.
Story.
Absolutely brilliant. I mean, even the first issue of the Hunted storyline, the first five pages were basically the first five pages of Kraven's Last Hunt, but now as the story, and with him following the same pattern of ritual, as he want Kraven once again, he's fed up of the hunt and he wants to get this out of the way, but he's no longer hunting Spider-Man. It's his son who's right. Hunting Spider-Man down, and he's going against his family. Brilliant storytelling. The Spider-Man comic has gone from strength to strength since Dan Slott left, and it's getting back to that whole feel of undoing all the mistakes of the past, but also linking everything together and bringing back that nostalgic feel. I know I say nostalgia is bad in some things, but sometimes it works in order to get a title back. And at the same time, I don't know whether you've caught the Spider-Man Life Story.
No.
Series. I've read the first issue of that.
Is that the J.J. Abrams one?
No, this is the Mark Bagley and Chip Zdarsky.
Well, I like Chip Zdarsky's work.
It's looking at, say, Spider-Man was 15 in the 60s. Now, if the character in the comic aged as the comics aged, how would the bigger impact of the world and also the Marvel Universe impact on that character? So the first issue focuses on the 60s as a teenager, and then it leads up to Vietnam War and Flash Thompson going off to war. But over the series, and I can't wait to read the rest of them, he's going to age alongside us. So by the time it gets to the ones of the 2000s, 2010s, he's going to be an old man. And it's going to be how Spider-Man adapts throughout the ages. Can't wait to see how this plays out. It's a great concept of another world kind of tale. Or should we say a what-if kind of tale.
Yeah, because all comics really aren't what-ifs.
Yeah. But yeah.
Sounds good.
Marvel Unlimited. Subscribe to it if you're behind on comics. If you want a jumping in point, you've only watched the Marvel films, and you've always thought, but where do you start? If you've got a tablet device, and who hasn't got a tablet device these days, just get yourself a subscription to it. You won't regret it. Even just put yourself down for just 1 month and trial it. I guarantee you'll then pay for the year straight afterwards, because there's so much backstory in there. You want a jumping in point? You can categorize it by characters, storylines, or main events. So just pick a big crossover event like Secret Wars, read through that.
Time to steal the tablet back from your kid. Scott.
I've just mostly been playing the re-release of Final Fantasy VIII for the Switch. They released 7, 8 and 9 Final Fantasies. Just I love turn-based Japanese RPGs, especially of that time. And it's the height of video games for me around that period, as is the height whenever people were the same age I was then. That's your height of video games. So I've just been replaying Final Fantasy VIII. I've not progressed since being 15.
I think Final Fantasy VIII was very underappreciated when it first got released. I remember there was a lot of negative backlash to it.
Well, VII was such a high.
But I'm revisiting it as well myself, and you know, I say revisiting it. I've got as far as collecting cards for the card game.
But that gets everyone.
Triple Triad, and that's it.
Dangerous game.
I'm going to stay with video games, but I'm going to. My neat thing for the week is the trailer for The Last of Us Part Two.
Ooh.
And if we can, I'd like to try and get a link on our page, because it looks beautiful. The Last of Us was, I'm not a huge gamer. I dip in and out. I've been playing Red Dead Redemption now since Christmas. I don't have the time to invest in games. So when I like a game, I throw everything at it. But I'm not in any stretch of the imagination a huge gamer. The Last of Us was the game that changed it for me. That was a game changer. That felt like being in a movie. I wept like a small girl when it ended.
The opening section of that game just completely captivates your heart and cripples you.
It was immersive in a way that I'd not played a game before. And I'm, as I said, not a big gamer, so my repertoire is not huge, but I found it incredibly emotional. I've played it a couple of times since. I'm ready to revisit The Last of Us again. I need it on for PS4, the remastered version, which is apparently the definitive version.
For people who have PS4, if you've got a PS Plus account, next week, Last of Us is the free game of the month.
Oh, right.
Awesome. So if you've never played Last of Us and you've got a PS4 or you want to revisit it and you don't know where your disc is, wait until next week, get it downloaded, and plough yourself through that story before the second part comes out next year.
The second part trailer landed this week, and boy, does it look fantastic. It was a hint of the gameplay, but I'd almost forgotten it was a game by looking at the trailer. I've got a sense of what the film's about. You're meeting some of the characters several years on. It felt like an emotional ride. It feels like a revenge drama from what I've seen on it. It's pure cinema. It's pure cinema in a game, and I'm all for that. I think the thin line between film and video game has got a whole lot thinner. I can't wait to next year. I'm saving. And if my partner's listening, I know what I want for Christmas. And that's it for the Film File episode 4. We'll be back, hopefully, to talk about The Joker.
Yep.
Because I think that's the big smile on everybody's lips that's happening real soon. From me, Lee Ford.
Andy Meakin.
Scott.
We'll see you again very soon.